Happy March, everyone. Spring is just around the corner, and I am super stoked to experience my new city when it's not dreary or covered in slushy, gross mush. Our guest today is a ray of sunshine and came on the show to talk about her experience with geo-arbitrage. Sarah Lee Kane taught overseas in China for 10 years before coming back home and starting several successful entrepreneurial endeavors. You are going to be heckin' inspired by her story.
Welcome to Fire Drill Podcast, where side hustles, savings, and creativity lead to financial independence. With your hosts, Gwen from Fiery Millennials and Jay from Millennial Boss.
Hey, Sarah, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Gwen and Jay.
And of course, can't do this without my awesome co-host, Jay. What's up?
Hello.
So, Sarah, tell us your quick 90-second rundown of who Sarah is.
Oh my goodness. Okay. Number one, I'm a very complex individual, but if you're talking about professionally what I do, I am primarily a finance freelance writer, former elementary school teacher who has lived overseas for the past, I'd say like 12 years, been a world traveler all my life, and specifically chose a career so that I can travel whenever I want. That's my philosophy on life, is like figure out how I can travel.
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack there, as some of our co-host friends say. So, Sarah, where did you grow up? Why did you decide that you wanted to start traveling when you were an adult?
I think I got the travel bug from my parents. And so I was actually born in Hong Kong, lived there until I think I was 4 or 5, and my parents decided to immigrate to Canada. And so every summer, really, since we moved to Canada, we've always flown back and forth to China and Hong Kong and visit relatives, because I still have a bunch of uncles and aunts there. So we've always traveled. And then we would tack on trips here and there, apart from just visiting family. So I always just grew up every year, every 6 months, going on a plane somewhere. And so I think I was just so used to that life that I couldn't really see any other way of living. And I've always found myself being a little bit of a rebel anyways. And so I started wanting to travel by myself instead of just with a group of people, partially because I'm selfish and I want to like wander places wherever I want. So I started doing that a little bit in college. First started traveling to Australia for a few weeks by myself, and then trips here and there kind of outside of Toronto, which is where I grew up. And yeah, that was really it.
Yeah. So like I didn't get the travel bug until later in life, because the furthest that I would travel would be to the next state over to hang out with my aunt and uncle for a week while my parents got to go travel for their anniversary week. So I am definitely jealous that you had more of that jet setting lifestyle exposure when you were a kid. It's fascinating to see how like the influences of your childhood manifest themselves as adults.
Yeah, it's so interesting, because I didn't realize, I wouldn't say I was weird, but kind of how different I was until I started talking about my experiences. And I remember this very vividly in grade 6. I left school a few days early. So my mom had put in a request for me to leave a few days early. I think they were giving out awards for different achievements. And so in my memory, I don't remember if this is true, but I remember they were like, oh, Sarah's going to need to receive her award because she's leaving. And everyone's like, where's she going? And it happened, we were actually going on a trip to Hawaii. And so everyone was just, I remember like looking out in the audience when I received this award, everyone's like, oh my gosh, Sarah's going to Hawaii and she's only 12. Like, this is crazy. And I think that was like the first time it really hit me that not everyone traveled the way I did. And so I'm like hyper aware of that, or I've been hyper aware of that.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you went through college and you graduated and you're like, okay, time for me to have a career. How did you juggle having a career with your desire to travel?
Okay, so ever since I was a kid, I knew that whatever job I were to take would have to involve some sort of travel. And so back then there wasn't anything like we have now, like digital nomads, working from your laptop, careers like that. But I remember teachers that did teacher exchanges overseas. So I remember we had a teacher from Australia who swapped homes with, I think it was my 5th grade teacher. And so I remember meeting this teacher from Australia. And I was like, okay, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a teacher, because if this guy can come all the way from Australia and still make money and travel, that's what I'm going to do. So my entire career choice, I mean, I love teaching, don't get me wrong, but my entire career choice was based on the fact that at that time I knew that I could take my teaching degree anywhere in the world and I would get paid to be in that country.
Which just seems like impossible to get, right? Like somebody would pay you to go travel and be in another country. Like how mind-boggling awesome is that?
Yeah, it's, and I'm not that old. I'm like 37. So, but back then, I mean, the internet isn't the way it is now. And so the opportunities that we see weren't available to me back then. I remember like when I first got my like AOL email account, like that was I think middle school, you know? So it was one of those where I didn't even think about entrepreneurship. I didn't think about that. I just knew like I needed a job that would pay me. And luckily, the cool perks about being a teacher. So I just want to distinguish between like a foreign, like English teacher and then a certified teacher, which means that you go overseas to teach at a school that's very much like what you'd find in the US, like a private school. So the cool perk about that, which I realized later in high school, because I met another teacher from Spain, was that you got housing paid for, you got a flight to and from, you know, your origin country, your home country. And it was great. I was like, okay, cool. That's awesome. Like I get paid to live there. And I get free flights home. Like, yes, I'm so going to be a teacher.
So when you did that, that was a while ago. Have you stayed abreast of any developments in that area? Like, would you have any advice for somebody who wants to go teach overseas?
I remember when I did it, I just kind of did a Google search and stumbled upon school. So you can definitely do that. But if you have some experience, like if you have at least 2 to 3 years of teaching experience, you know, in Canada, US, or I guess in an English speaking country, then you can find recruitment agencies. And so you pay maybe like 100, 200 bucks. And that puts you in a pool of other teachers. And so they have the more known one is called Search Associates. And they have recruitment fairs. I think there's like 10 of them each year. And so if you show up in person, you're more likely to get a job because most of these interviews are over Skype or on a phone call. And so if someone's going to hire you to move across the world and trust that you can teach their students, then it's better if you can meet the person who's hiring you in person rather than through Skype. So that's one. Number two is most people get master's degrees. Now, I don't know if this is like, I don't have one, but I hear that like, if you get one, it's easier because that kind of puts you a little bit like more competitive, I guess, compared to other teachers. But experience is definitely the main one if you were to want to teach overseas.
You've been working overseas for a while now. How did you like handle dating? And like, because I know that you are married with a kid now. So like, how did that all work in the greater scope of working overseas?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think when you're overseas, especially in my experience, I lived in different countries where English wasn't widely spoken. Like that wasn't the first language. And so the expats really kind of bonded together based on the fact that we all spoke English. And so there's a lot of, I think there's probably more now, but I remember when I first moved overseas, there's a lot of forums and you can kind of go online and find out different activities and meetups. Flickr, I don't know if anybody knows Flickr, but that was a photo sharing site, I guess similar to Instagram. And so I remember meeting people through that because I'm an amateur photographer. So I would meet people online and we would like do meetups and things like that. A lot of coworkers become really good friends just because, again, you all speak English, you're new to the country, you kind of just have that common bond. So it's really easy to meet people. And in terms of dating, I mean, a lot of coworkers end up dating each other. That's actually how I met my husband, was that we worked together in China. It was like the first day of school. I saw him at the gate. We said hello. He claims his love at first sight, right? My claim is we became friends and then started dating. So that's how I met my husband. And a lot of couples end up dating coworkers or getting married to coworkers.
Okay, super cute story. So pardon me while I get all jealous. So you met your husband and then you guys are like, hey, let's start a family. So was there anything that you did differently while you were trying to have kids and then while your son was coming along?
One of the considerations we really had to think about was whether I wanted to give birth overseas. I didn't really know the health system that well. And unfortunately, in China, it's not known to be the best. And if you think about childbirth, it's kind of a major deal. And so I was really apprehensive about whether or not I wanted to give birth in a place where English wasn't primarily spoken. So there are lots of what they call, I guess, foreign hospitals, which is doctors who speak English or nurses who speak English, or they have lots of translators, but they're very expensive compared to what you would normally pay at a public hospital. So for example, if you were to go to the doctor, let's say you have a cold, at a public hospital, you pay a max $10. That includes medicine. But at a private hospital, you could pay up to like $40, $50. You're talking about like five times what you would normally pay, right, for the privilege of someone speaking English. And so it was a little bit stressful because if I were to give birth like across the border in Hong Kong, which doctors still primarily spoke English, you could, like 99% of places will speak English, it required me to have to take significantly more time off because I literally would have to cross the border from mainland China to Hong Kong. I couldn't cross the, you know, back through. And, you know, after birth, I would need some time to recuperate, etc. And so it was a lot of like crunching numbers and negotiating with my employer how much time I could take off. Because the other issue that you may run into when you're overseas is that you may not have something in your contract for maternity leave. So the local staff do. The local staff, you can get up to 3 months off. But foreign staff, I had nothing in my contract. And so basically before we even decided we wanted to have children, I had to go to my boss and was like, this is what we're considering. Like, if I were to fall pregnant, what can we do? And so it was like very unsexy, like numbers, researching hospitals, like, do we need to set aside money? Because at that point too, how my health insurance worked was that you had to pay for all of your procedures up front and then you get reimbursed. And so it ended up being, I think with like prenatal, postnatal, everything, it ended up costing us $25,000. And so we had to like make sure we had that money up front to be able to get reimbursed. So it was a lot of thinking about that. Yeah, it was a lot of like thinking about that, whether or not that we couldn't afford it, because we can get into that, like how we just saved tons of money. So like the money wasn't the issue. It was like, can we set this aside? Can I afford to take time off if it needed to be unpaid leave? Or will my job even be there when I come back or when I'm ready to come back?
Okay, first, I like how you said, you know, if I were to fall pregnant, like, it's just like you fell flat with the flu or something.
I'm trying to think of like the term, but anyways, yeah.
If you were to get pregnant.
If I were to get pregnant, yes.
It's difficult to save up money in the first place sometimes. But I find that it's not the saving part that's difficult for me. It's the not spending it part when I do save up money. So I'm like, ooh, look at all this money I have. Look at all the things that I could buy, things that I could do. And then you're like, wait a minute. No, this is earmarked for a specific reason. No touchy. Like, that's the hard part for me.
Yeah. You know, when you're overseas, you kind of don't have, again, I don't know because I don't speak or read or write or Chinese very well. I don't know if you could have like opened another savings account and I could have transferred money like that, you know, kind of how you would do with different accounts in the US. Like I didn't have that kind of luxury. I didn't know if there was such thing. And so like when we saw the numbers, we were like, okay, we have to keep it in here. We'd get paid in cash. And so like we would have to then deposit it into the bank. We would get paid partially in US dollars. So then we had like US cash. It was kind of, I don't want to say it was a mess, but it was like, it was a different way of thinking about allotting our spending. But again, like I mentioned, you know, we got housing paid for in China. Like the standard of living is like super low compared to the US. I'm trying to remember exact numbers, but like we were making the equivalent of what an experienced teacher would make in the US. And so like if you're talking about average restaurant meal as $5 and an average meal you cook at home is like less than a dollar, for us, it was like not difficult at all to save. And so it wasn't the issue of saving money. It was like, how do we allocate this so that we know that this was set aside for the medical expenses? And how do we keep track of all the receipts? Because we had to submit all of that. It turned out to be a lot of paperwork. Mm-hmm.
I read an article that you wrote that you one time carried $20,000 in cash across the border. Would you mind telling that story?
Yeah. So back in the day, no, this was like, what, 10 years ago? It was difficult to transfer money out of the country in China. So China's sort of made it difficult for expats to transfer money out because they want to keep the money in the country, obviously. And so I remember it would take us on average 2 hours to make a wire transfer. Even when I knew the banker, like he had all my information, it still took like an hour and a half. And you paid like the fees were ridiculous. It was almost like $100 each time plus the exchange rate. It was like, it was insane. And we were like, this is crazy. And so what we discovered was, okay, well, why don't we just take the cash out? There was this like exchange booth that gave us a really good exchange rate for US dollars. Why don't we just take money out in cash, get it exchanged in US dollars, and then bring it over to the US? And so the maximum amount that you can carry in cash, and that includes like any gold and valuables, things like that, was $10,000 per family. So this was like before my husband and I got married. And so we technically weren't a family. And so we were like, okay, we could technically bring a maximum of $10,000 each in cash into the country without it being a big deal. And so that's what we ended up doing, was like, because we would fly home like every summer. We did fly home during Christmas. And so we're like, okay, we will just literally hide money under our mattresses. We hid it like in different parts of our apartment because we were paranoid that someone would take it. And so it was really funny. When we had all this cash, I was like, can we just like throw it on the bed and like pretend we're millionaires? And so we did that before we had to figure out how to like transport, you know, $10,000 each across the world, essentially.
How many hours did you fly with that? And I'm imagining you had like $100 bills like stuffed into jackets and socks. Like, how did you do it?
Yeah, we had like laptop cases. My husband had cargo pants and they were like two pockets on each side of his pants. We had jackets. We could put them in jackets. And then whenever we went through security, after that, we put them into like our carry-on luggage. And we were like, we held on to it, like, you know, our life depended on it. Average flight from China to Pittsburgh, is where my husband's family's from, is, gosh, a direct flight, not direct flight, sorry, almost direct flight, 16 hours. I mean, at one point we would fly like 20 hours with layovers and things like that. So it was a long flight.
Yeah, that's brutal.
Do you know of any easier ways now? Have things changed and there are easy ways to transfer money out of China now?
Yes, yes. There's much easier ways now. Yeah, like I know I have a few friends who say that the wire transfer process is much easier and they've loosened up on the fees. And I think, you know, don't quote me on this, but I think Bank of America and there's some other bank where, but I think they partnered up with banks in China where the wire transfer fee is like zero or heavily, heavily discounted. And so I know people who send money home every month and it's much easier for them. I think Western Union or MoneyGram is much cheaper now. And so it's become a lot easier. Like when we brought all that cash, that was probably 2009. So like 10 years ago. But like China has evolved so much in the last 10 years. It's like insane. So I imagine it's easier now. And it's also easier if you know like a local, because they can do wire transfers online. And so if you trust someone to do that wire transfer, you can give them the money and they'll do it for you, like if it's a trusted friend. So I know people who've done that, but we kind of were very paranoid about about somebody running with their money, so we didn't do that option.
I mean, rightfully so, because that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Gwen and I use TransferWise to pay someone, a virtual assistant who does work for us in Scotland. I wonder if TransferWise will let you transfer from China too. But the good thing is that the fees are much cheaper than PayPal.
Yeah. I mean, there's, gosh, like in the last couple of years, like all these awesome fintech companies have just popped up. Like I wish we had all of that back when I was over there. I really do.
I wonder what would happen if you tried to use a Charles Schwab account, because I know they're really good with like ATM stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just be curious to see how that, maybe if somebody knows how that works or if they're currently working overseas, you could chime in our Facebook group and let us know what some of the options are nowadays. Okay, so I'm assuming that you didn't want to teach and live in China forever. So did you make any plans ahead of time to come back to North America, or did you just kind of be like, well, we're done and we're going to fly back to North America now? How did that process work out?
Yeah, so when my husband and I first got married, this was 2010, we were thinking about, okay, if we don't want to stay in China long term, are we going to another country? We were thinking like Thailand at the time or Kuwait, like where do we want to do? It was a lot of discussion back and forth because it was more difficult for my husband to get residency in Canada than it was for me to get a green card to the US. And so that was like one consideration, was okay, what's easier to get? And maybe we can just get, like, I can get a green card and then we can go from there. And so I ended up applying for a green card a couple years later. So probably 2012. And so we went through that. And it was always the intention of, okay, if we were to like have kids and move back to North America, we can make a go of it in the US. And then if, you know, whatever reason, we really like Canada or the thought of Canada more, we can go to Canada. And so it was kind of one of those where like we discussed the possibility of moving back, but we still really, really enjoyed the expat lifestyle. And we weren't really ready to go back. It wasn't a very serious consideration to come to the US until I got pregnant. After I gave birth, it was a pretty intense experience giving birth overseas. We were like, if going to a hospital is this frustrating, can you imagine if, because I remember like being really upset. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so thankful my son was born to term and he's healthy. But I'm like, can you imagine if like an actual emergency happened and we couldn't communicate, or I don't ever remember seeing an ambulance. Like, what if there's no such thing as an ambulance? Postpartum randomness. But anyway, I was like going through all these scenarios. And so we then really made a serious commitment to move back to the North America, because we were like, at least it'll give us some peace of mind that if we were in the US or in Canada, we at least understand the health system. And so by this point, I got my green card and we were like, okay, so it makes more sense to get or to come to the US because I have a green card. And number two, it was actually easier for my son to get US citizenship than it was to get Canadian citizenship. So we literally just had to show up at the embassy, and then he was able to get like a passport and a certificate of citizenship in like 2 weeks. So it was like crazy versus I think Canada was like 8 to 9 months. And so we were like, okay, so maybe this is like the universe telling us that we should just be in the US. And so once we decided that, I had to think about my teaching license, because I'm certified in Canada. It doesn't automatically mean it would work in the US. And so I had to really start thinking about considering, do I want to recertify in the US? Do I want to put my son in daycare all day, or do I want to stay home with him? That was something else I was thinking about. And so I'm like, what can I do in case it would take me over a year to get recertified? And so that's really when I ramped up my freelance writing side hustle. And so it was a lot of like getting paperwork, a lot of me preparing in case I wanted to leave my teaching career and all of that, and just saving more money. Because we didn't know if we wanted to buy a house. We had no idea where in the US we were going to be, because my husband was just literally applying to teaching jobs all over the country. and so that was really our plan.
Did you have anything that you started doing in China to make the transition a little easier when you came over to North America?
Aside from growing that side hustle, I'm just so used to moving from country to country that I just was like, I'll keep an open mind. Because I was like, oh man, if I can like just move to Korea, this was when I was in Canada. I'm like, if I can just move to Korea in a few weeks, not knowing anything about the country, I can do this. If I can move to Australia with a one-way ticket, no guarantee of a job, I can do this. And so that was my attitude moving to the US. And it was one of those things where we also, it was kind of me insisting on like a massive emergency fund. So we had like 2 years worth of expenses saved up. We estimated, of course, but we're like, if my husband didn't find a job, like my side hustle completely failed, like when it turned into a full-time venture, we had 2 years of runway to survive on. And like worst case scenario, we'll just get another teaching job overseas. So that's really mentally how I prepared and emotionally prepared. And in terms of like the money side, like I said, I wanted to make sure that I was able to replace my full-time income with my side hustle. So it was a lot of like working super late at night, typing on the laptop while my son was sleeping in my arms, like a lot of that kind of hustling just to make sure I can ramp up my side gig.
Now that side gig is your full-time gig, right? Like, how did that transition work?
It felt very sudden because I had that side. So that side hustle was like since 2012. So when we left, gosh, when we landed in the US, it was like 2016. So like a three and a half year side hustle. It was always like a hobby, because I was like, oh, I just like to write and I get paid and it's fun. But then when I ramped it up, it was like just a lot. It was seriously thousands and thousands of cold pitches. At one point, I did get up in the middle of the night to do cold calls, which in retrospect, I'm like, I should have just slept. But that's what I did. I would call, because back then I wrote for textbook companies too. So I'd call these textbook companies and be like, hey, this is my experience. Do you need a writer? It was just a lot of pitches. It was a lot of writing. And I don't remember sleeping all that much. And this was like even with a newborn.
So how has it been being a full-time freelance writer for the last 3 or so years?
In the beginning, it was extremely challenging. So it was more the mindset aspect of it. So like, you know, I was doing pretty well. I did replace my teacher's salary by the time I left my last job. So the money side wasn't the difficult part. The difficult part was I did not anticipate how isolating it would have been to be a freelance writer. So number one, I was in a new country, in a new town. I didn't know anybody. I had this little kid and we were struggling to find part-time daycare at this small little town. So I had this kid who was teething, upset. I'm trying to write. And then I didn't feel like I had anybody to share my frustrations with. Like my husband was very supportive and is very supportive, but it was one of those where I wanted to speak to somebody who was a freelance writer who could understand the specifics of what I was really frustrated with. And so I didn't necessarily have that. I mean, I had friends, but they were all like a 45-minute drive away. So it was like, okay, do I want to pack up my kid and drive 45 minutes one way for coffee and then come back? So it was really like, okay, the nature of freelancing can be feast or famine. So I was going through that. Then I was adjusting to the US, which I was not expecting to be such a big adjustment. And then I was adjusting to new motherhood and isolation. And so it almost got too much. It got to the point where I, 7 months into it, I was telling my friend, I'm like, I'm going back to a full-time job. I can't handle this. And I'm like, it's not even about the money. It's just, I can't handle all of the mindset and the stress. And luckily she convinced me to stick it out a little bit more. And then we did end up moving to Florida from that little town. It's funny because once we moved to a bigger city, I got to meet more people. We found like way more childcare options was when my income actually doubled because all of that stress went away. Like not went away, it like really severely diminished. So for me, it was like the hustling and the earning the money part was easy. It was like everything else around it was the difficult stuff.
Yeah. And I can testify that Sarah is an excellent resource to talk to about all that stuff because we had this amazing heart-to-heart chat at FinCon last year. She helped me realize a whole bunch of things about myself and about side hustling and being an entrepreneur and being a writer specifically. So she's really great to talk to. 10 out of 10 would recommend.
Oh, thanks, Glenn. Well, you were definitely very open. So I think that's definitely one of the things I had to really be honest with myself was when I transitioned even like to motherhood. I was like, I just had to be really open and honest about my feelings and like where I was at. Because, you know, like, let's say you want to save a ton of money or you want to earn a ton of money. Like there's all this outside stuff that's going on and you can't, I don't want to say react, but if there's not a way for you to process those feelings, like they're just going to gnaw at you. And then it's going to really distract you from what it is that you're trying to achieve or trying to get.
Absolutely.
Where did you land in the balance of work and motherhood?
Oh my goodness. that is an excellent question. The balance, it took like a good year to figure that out. And then when I figured it out, we moved to the US and then to refigure it out. So in terms of balance, I just had to be extra clear with my boundaries. And by that, I just had to be really, really blunt with my husband in terms of like, this is what I need. And if you come home and I'm on the computer, this is what this means. And so he was very supportive and he knew that like, as I was trying to basically keep my head above water, he was like, okay, well, you need space and I can give you that. And then I would turn off my laptop at a certain time and then we would have family time. And so it really was just a lot of like negotiating boundaries, figuring out like, okay, I've noticed that my husband doesn't feel like we're spending enough time together. I have to find a way to be a lot more efficient in what I'm doing. It also meant letting go of some clients. Not that they weren't great clients, but it was just one of those where those projects were taking a lot of time and I couldn't get hyper efficient about what I was doing. So right now my family is more important, so I'm going to let that go. So it was really just assessing like how much time is something taking? Is it really worth it in terms of working for the sake of working versus this is really for my family. And it got a bit easier as my son is older now, so he's almost 4. And so now that he's going to preschool, I make sure that all of my really deep work, so in terms of like writing articles or interviews, podcast interviews or interviews for articles, I do that when he's not at home. And then when he is home, I do things that are more admin-like. And then I have a hard and fast rule now that 4:30 comes, I am done for the day, like no more work. If it's not finished, I leave it to the next day. And so it's just continually assessing my priorities and my values. And if work has to look different, if I have to work on a Saturday, then I have to work on a Saturday if it means that I have more time with my son or my husband on a weekday. So just getting very, very clear on that.
What are your financial goals?
I want to be a millionaire. I would love to be one by the time I'm 50. So I have like 13 years to go. And our net worth is pretty sizable. I'm not going to say it because I don't think my husband's comfortable with revealing numbers, but we're at a pretty good spot to be FI by the time I'm 50. And in terms of my business, I would love to double my income again this year. So I do have some plans up my sleeve on how I want to do that. We are also looking at purchasing our first home by the end of this year. And I convinced my husband that we could house hack. And so we just talked to the realtor that actually specializes in that. So we're like doing all the numbers and figuring out what area we want to live in and all that, because we have a down payment saved already. So
you guys have done a lot of international travel, and you've done some of the things that people who want to hit their financial independence number do. When you're saying you want to be FI, what does that actually look like to you?
It's so funny because I got asked that question. They're like, what would you do differently? And I'm like, I probably wouldn't live any differently than the way I do now. The only thing I would think that would be different is I probably wouldn't be freelance writing as much. Like, I really enjoy it. So that part I won't stop. But probably I'd be a lot more picky about the types of clients that I write for. So maybe less what I would deem boring work. Probably do more journalistic type articles where I really get to interview cool people and write those types of articles, like topics that interest me more. So it just gives me, you know, being FI can give me kind of leverage to take on more what I would consider interesting projects. My husband, for him, I don't think he wants to stop working either. But for him, I think he has his like aspiration to write novels. And so he wants to free up more time to do that. And so if we're to sum it up, it's really just to find more purpose-driven work for all of us. And I want to be able to be in a position where if my son wants us to help him with college or just to have more time with him, then we can be in that position to do that as well.
Awesome. Sarah, thank you so much for coming on today. If people want to get in touch with you, how can they do so?
Yeah, so I have a podcast called Beyond the Dollar. So beyondthedollar.co. Definitely check me out there. Season 4 is launching on March 6th. So come check that out. And then I'm on Instagram. I'm trying not to be on Instagram too much because I'm getting addicted again. But you can find me on Instagram at Beyond the Dollar.
Jay, would you like to ask the final question?
Yes. Sarah, what is your wildest dream?
Oh my gosh. I want to own a yacht. That is my wildest dream.
Oh my gosh. I just had Maren Morris's song flash in my head about owning a yacht. That's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. What type of yacht are we talking about? Like a giant, everyone wears white type party yacht, or like a sailing the ocean yacht?
Okay. Yeah. No, now that you ask that, I do want like a big party yacht where I can invite like families or tons of people, like hundreds of people, and we can just, it'd be like a cruise ship. Like that's how big I want it. And, you know, we would eat and lounge by the pool. I want like a Mickey Mouse shaped pool. So the ears would be like a jacuzzi and then eat and chillax and drink however much we want.
So we're invited on your hypothetical yacht, right?
Yeah, of course. Of course.
Oh, perfect. Wonderful. I've always wanted a friend with a yacht.
Yeah, me too. But hey, if I get to own one, then yeah, you're all invited.
Woohoo! Party on Sarah's yacht.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Go to our website, firedrillpodcast.com, to continue the discussion and get the link to our private Facebook group.
If you like us, leave us a review on iTunes. If you're like me, you have no idea how to do that. So, in the podcast app or in iTunes, search for Fire Drill Podcast, find it, click the Reviews tab, and write something to make my mother proud of me. We read every single review and want to say thank you from the bottom of our hearts for making this podcast possible.